2015, an elite DFS Army Commando unit formed to bring high-level DFS strategy to the masses. Today, hated by DFS sharks and lineup sellers alike, they continue their quest to turn Joe into DFS pro.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is your DFS Army Daily Dispatch, brought to you by DFSArmy.com. I am your host, Boomer's Daddy, and joining me, as always, well, not always, but most of the time, is the one, the only, the Chalk Eater himself, Chop Em Down. How you doing this morning, Chop?
I've been better, man. No, I'm just kidding. I'm freaking great.
I was about to say, damn, somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
Nah, dude, I'm good.
Oh, man. How was your Mother's Day?
Well, it wasn't my Mother's Day to have, but let me tell you, it's never a dull moment around here when you got three kids trying to cook breakfast for. We got up and we tried to make this comfort food, this Southern Slam thing that I like to have after my poker nights. You got a bed of hash browns, little sausage gravy, throw some eggs in there, a little sausage, you know, kind of mix all that stuff up. Man, it is just a heart attack waiting to happen, but it is so good. I got my wife's breakfast made. I was making my own, and my daughter came up and said, I had some of Mom's. It tasted really good. Can I have some? Sure, no problem. Spoon her out some, and then the fiasco began because it's not really hot. And then, of course, we ran out of eggs. And then, of course, I needed to go back to the store again to get gravy because we ran out of grate. I was like, oh, my God, I made like six trips to the store. It was like I was trying to fix my bathroom sink and had to go back to Home Depot like eight times to get the thing done. So,
oh, wow.
Now, the day went great. My morning was shit. But, again, not my day, not my morning to have. So I just kind of sucked it up and took one for the team there, buddy.
There you go. Yeah, we have a Mother's Day tradition down here for us, and it was kind of it was a little bit interesting. You know, we kind of split up a couple of the holidays, but on for Mother's Day for us, for her mom, for my wife's mom, we go to the zoo. We get up, we go to breakfast, and we go to the zoo. And so it was Katie's first experience going to the zoo. And, man, I kid you not, 5 weeks old, he took it like a champ. Slept through most of it and ate.
That's all,
other than,
that's all you can ask for.
Me. Yeah,
did
other
you,
than
did you
me
have
having
to use,
did
you have to use one of those nasty public restrooms?
I did use them, but KD did not go in them. When I had to change them, I changed them out in the middle of public on a bench.
Yeah, boy.
So, whenever somebody went to the restroom there, I made sure I lathered them down. Not that I'm a germaphobe or anything like that, but I made sure that I got them lathered down in freaking, hand sanitizer before they touched my son again. So, I don't care about family trading their germs and stuff like that, and I understand he's gonna get sick from
right,
time
it's
to
everybody
time,
else's germs.
But, yeah, exactly. When you got that many people there on a Mother's Day, then it's one of those things. But we did that and then came home and I watched the first three innings of the Rockies game. Of course, I had everything recorded yesterday just to make sure that I wouldn't miss it because it was a big sports day for me, as Mother's Day usually is. And then we went and we took my mom to dinner. And went to a Mexican restaurant about 20 minutes away and had some good time. And she got to oogle and ogle and Google over how big KD's gotten. And, you know, it was he was awake for most of that experience. So he loved it and came home. And me and him watched the Rockies game. And then we watched the Thunder's game. And It was great. It was a great day,
That's
man.
Good.
It was,
good.
It was good. So.
I don't know. I'll be interested to see how your wife does as the years go on when the kids get old enough to, kind of do the whole breakfast thing. And I wonder if she's going to want it to be her day for a while or if she's going to still want to include all of the other mothers, because my wife did an about face in the beginning. We were, let's do your mom, do my mom, whatever. Now it's, let's do your mom on Saturday and my mom next weekend, and let's not touch anything. Let's not go anywhere. Let's not do anything. I just want breakfast in bed. I want to watch my TV. I want to be left alone. And it's really funny. I didn't see my mom yesterday. I gave her a phone call, and we saw my wife's mom the night before because she wanted to see her then, and that was actually it was a beautiful thing because we didn't have the family obligations like you do around Thanksgiving, Christmas, bounce around and go to this house and that house and all that baloney. We got our day to ourselves. So
yeah, I mean, I don't mind it. It's whenever me and my mom and dad and Heather go out, I take care of ours and they take care of theirs. And Mother's Day is the one day of the year I get to pay for my mom and dad. They don't let me pay otherwise. I even tried to, I think it was for, I think it was for her birthday, my mom's birthday, and my dad took I try to take the bill, as quickly as I possibly can or go pay it discreetly. And, my dad has kind of figured that out because, I don't get to pay for him
right.
that often anymore. And, he's kind of figured it out and he's kind of worked his way around it, and he'll either steal the bill or ask for the bill when I'm in the bathroom or go pay it discreetly now. So it's a race to the bill, which is actually kind of funny. So, but man, we've got a great week ahead of us. It was a great weekend. We had some big winners, in the DFS Army. Got a lot of fun stuff going on right now. We're working on, I know me and you, we're working on a way to kind of distinguish a matchups model, and we're going to be working on that. That should be coming hopefully pretty soon as well, once we get the details worked out in that. And it's going to be a lot of fun. You're going to want to make sure you tune into the live shows this afternoon. Triple Play is going to be fantastic because I don't know if you paid attention on Friday, but I think I made Mr. Al Walsh DFS a little jealous with his replacement on Friday. I had Big Italy 42 from and big shout out to him. Thanks again for coming on the show with me and doing it in short notice. He's from Daily Fantasy Circuit. He works with Gabriel Harper over there. You know him as Crazy Gaby, who I'm hoping to do an interview with this week sometime for our pod. And he's a good guy. He's very, very, very knowledgeable as far as baseball is concerned, and being able to kind of bring in a different mind to that time slot was fantastic. But got a new little surprise for everybody for the intro to Triple Play today. It's gonna be quite fantastic, I think. So that's ready to rock and roll. So
yeah, you have to definitely tune in and take a listen if you. Because as these guys know, you and I on Monday, Wednesday, Friday talk reserve the slate breakdown for you guys in the afternoon. We do a little bit more conceptual strategy type talk or whatever you want to call it. So, yeah, definitely need to tune into both.
Yeah, because I mean we're actually recording this one late, but normally when we record this at 9:30 in the morning Central Time, there's just so much, like lineups aren't even out yet. We're hoping to. As the very amateur meteorologists that we are, maybe accurately predict the weather, and it's so much easier to do it, later on than it is, usually. And one of the reasons why we do Tuesdays and Thursdays is usually because, you know, now we kind of know how the series are getting set up. There aren't too many series that starts on Tuesdays, or, you know, you got your split slates on Thursdays. So it's really easy to kind of set up and go through a slate breakdown, because we have an idea of what's going to happen and what's going on. But Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, you know, I think it's a great time to, you know, do a recap on the weekend and dive into strategy talk and stuff like that as well. And you can tell your UPS man that he can, you know, stop interrupting our show, because we're trying to amass to the entertainment of millions.
Yeah,
here.
What's up with that? I've already had to wave a guy off last week. I was like, had my earplugs in, and I turned around, and I was just like waving the guy off. I'm like, dude, get lost.
Oh man, yeah, it's a lot of fun. People don't understand. I used to love it, because when I first started doing this and working from home, my wife used to text me, and she goes, "What are you doing?" "I'm working." "Oh, okay. What are you working on?" "Come on, baby." So now she knows she knows what to do now. So a couple quick things to recap on the weekend. One, have you seen this stat by Bryce Harper? He has not had a quote unquote official at bat in 16 plate appearances.
What?
Yeah, his last 16 plate appearances were like intentional walk, sacrifice hit. Hit by pitch, walk.
I clearly have not seen that statistic. Did Barry Bonds even ever do that 16 in a row?
No, it's a major league record. Like, the Cubs this last weekend said, "All right, Washington, everybody else is going to beat us.
That
you're not."
Figures, because that's a Joe Maddon thing to do. Joe Maddon was hell on Bonds when he faced him, too. He was very much a... "Look, dude, I'm going to reduce your lineup to 8 men, because this dude right here is going to be permanently parked on first base." I love it, honestly. And it goes into some other things we may get into someday with the whole shift stuff and whatever. I got a fairly unique opinion on the shift, and that I love it, because
we're going to get into that.
Cool,
here
if you want to stick all 9 guys out there in right freaking field, I say go for it, because you're totally going to pay the price if I've got a guy that learns how to bunt it down the third base line. It's all risk reward. Everything you do is risk reward. You run a risk in putting Bryce Harper on first base, in that the next guy pops in 2 instead of letting Bryce pop in 1. I mean, it's just like, what are you going to do? You got to take your
The theory is, and it's a little bit different with Bryce Harper, because, I mean, yesterday he was 0-for-0 with 1 run scored and 6 walks. I kid you not, literally he was 0-for-0, and I have never seen that. But when the Washington Nationals go 1-for-19 with runners in scoring position and leave 21 men on base, I mean, I think you're going to, until some of these other bats start coming around, I mean, Ryan Zimmerman behind him was 1-for-7 and left 14 men on base.
Now, why would you pitch the guy? I am an idiot if I pitch to Bryce Harper and he's got that kind of lack of protection in the lineup. I'm a moron.
I think you're going to start seeing it more and more with Harper, because nobody else in that line. And, you know, and my theory is, with Chicago, you've got Chris Bryant, you've got Anthony Rizzo right behind him. You can't really walk Chris Bryant to get to Anthony Rizzo, because guess what? Anthony Rizzo could pop a 2-run bomb real quick. But I'm not afraid of Ryan Zimmerman.
No.
Daniel Murphy, he's hitting the ball all over the yard, but he's not hitting it for power. You know, no. He's got a .395 average with a 1.079 OPS, but he doesn't scare me. Jason Worth, please, okay, whatever. Wilson Ramos, Danny Espinosa. The Washington Nationals, in my opinion, unless one of these guys behind him, either Zimmerman or Murphy, or if they move Harper back to the leadoff spot, unless he gets walked, steals second, steals third, and somebody's or something like that, I don't know what they got to do, and that's going to be for Dusty Baker to figure out, because I don't think that Baker would have a good answer. Unless one of these guys gets hot, I'm not going to let Bryce Harper beat me. Another interesting note is Joe Maddon did send Jason Hamill to pinch hit yesterday, which I thought was actually kind of funny. He said, screw it, I'm not going to burn one of my good pinch hitters because Jake Arrieta only threw 5 innings yesterday. He did allow 2 earned runs, so he looked a little human, but, you know, that's kind of what happens from time to time. You know, let's see here. Oh, Big Poppy, he's on fire.
Yep.
Pittsburgh is now the second best team in the Central, in my opinion, right now. Not probably at
the
end
Central
of the year, but
just
right
in the
now,
National League or what?
National League Central.
I think they have been the whole time, personally.
Well, it depends.
I think I'm firmly sitting on a third place team in this division.
I think your pitching overall, when it gets going, is better than theirs, because the back end of that rotation for them and Jeff Locke isn't as good as they have been in previous years. At least not at this point. But
agreed. But we haven't seen it yet here, so.
What's going to hurt you is exactly how long is Carlos Martinez going to be out, and if he is out for a while, how well does Tyler Lyons step into that spot to take over? Because Lyons came in on, I think it was Friday, and looked really good. Got himself out of a bases-loaded jam, I think threw another couple scoreless innings.
He can,
but
he's
not fully stretched.
Yeah, he can be exposed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well,
otherwise
yeah,
he'd be up here and in the rotation. So,
well, I mean, he was in the bullpen because you guys, I mean, you had an abundance of starting pitching. You know, Wainwright's going to eventually come around. He's looked better his last couple starts. He's not going to be the dominant pitcher that he once was, but, you know, he's a good serviceable. I think the problem with the Cardinals is you lack a true number one. Now, with that said, Waka has looked phenomenal his last couple starts until yesterday. he had looked really, really good until yesterday. But I think I still think it's a three-team race there. As far as the National League West, don't look now, but and I'm abundant to say this, but this is going to be a 3-4 team race for most of the year. Now, what the third team is going to be besides San Francisco and Los Angeles is yet to be seen. It's going to be either Colorado or Arizona. I think it's going to depend on whether or not Colorado can get to that dominance back at Coors Field, because they've shown they can compete and win low scoring games on the road
this year. Right.
You know, this was the first – we had our a 10-game road trip that we just came through, and this was the first time in club history that we've had a Western 10-game road trip and that we finished above 500. Now, it was only 6-4, but with that said, you know, when you're talking about places that haunt you, houses of horror, the only other house of horrors that – not house of horrors, but house of horrors – that actually are worse for the Rockies are when we go on that Eastern road trip of, you know, like Atlanta and Pittsburgh and, you know, stuff like that. That one sucks too. But, you know, we manufactured runs off of Jeff Samardzija yesterday. Obviously the Giants have an issue that they have to address on the back end of that rotation. Peavy and Kane are just not going to get it done. If these guys hope to stay in contention, they're gonna have to figure something out on the back end of that rotation. That bullpen is still good. Los Angeles went into Toronto, and I know Toronto's not hitting the ball well, but they took 2 out of 3 from the Blue Jays this weekend. Now San Francisco gets Toronto this weekend in San Francisco. Arizona goes to Colorado. San Diego goes to Chicago, and I just don't think that San Diego's their offense isn't going to produce enough. So yeah, if the Arizona pitching can come around the top end of that rotation with Greinke and Miller, I think that they've got talent. you know, there to compete with the West. And if Colorado can get to dominance at home, we could have a nice little four-team race. Because I don't think the Giants are great, and I don't think the Dodgers are great, to be completely honest. I mean, you've got Kershaw there, but without a solid number two, Maeda looked good this weekend in Toronto, but they got to him a little bit later. So it's going to be interesting just after the first month. It's kind of a nice little race. Out west or out east in the National League, it's the Mets and it's the Washington Nationals, and then it's everybody else living in that world. I mean, the Mets are 19-11, the Washington Nationals are 19-12, and good luck to everybody else. Hope you enjoyed your season. Surprisingly, the Philadelphia Phillies are still only two games back, but I don't think they have the stamina to actually compete with this. And surprisingly, the Miami Marlins are 16-14. That is surprising. So, going out to the American League, Boston is good, ladies and gentlemen. And Steven Wright is, he might be the best knuckleballer that I've seen in real life, or like in my history of watching baseball. And this is going back to Tom Candiotti, Tim Wakefield, all of them. The way that he absolutely, do you realize he didn't allow a home or a run until the ninth inning?
I did not realize that.
He absolutely shut down the Yankees.
We saw it
yesterday.
In that one magical year out of R.A. Dickey. I mean, when the ball's dancing and staying in the zone but moving quickly and late, I mean, they're hard to hit.
Yeah, it's when we talk about, you know, underlying statistics for pitchers, I think they're applicable and applicable for every single pitcher except for a knuckleballer. Just because they're what we used to think of as left-handed pitchers, how they're just kind of off. You know, they're a little quirky, crazy.
Oh, yeah, a little goofy.
You know, except it's one of those things that you just can't. Okay, you're gonna take. They're always gonna be GPP plays. You're gonna take a shot on them every single time, and they're not gonna strike out a lot. But they have the ability to. He had 91 pitches through eight innings going into the ninth inning last night. It was unbelievable the way he just worked up and down that lineup. And I know the Yankees lineup is not that good. They're 11-18 and. But that's still, you're talking about a Yankees lineup that was, and it was in Yankee Stadium. So you've got that left-handed short porch, and it was unbelievable to watch that last night. I watched the replay of it. The White Sox. Take notice. The White Sox are for real. They're 22-10,
they've
brother.
They've been a little surprising.
I think that's probably the biggest surprise, honestly, in majors, in the major leagues, as far as a positive surprise. I'll get to my negative surprise in a minute.
I'd say more power to them, though, because...
But they're not hitting. They're not a... Statistically, they are not a good offensive team. That is what is crazy. But they are... Good, exactly. They are good enough to where they can produce and manufacture runs. I mean, they're 22nd against right-handed pitch or left-handed pitching in the majors. Their numbers against right-handed pitching aren't that much better. They're 16th. They're not doing anything that's wowing you, but you know, whether it be the strength of the schedule so far or you know, they're still. They're 12-5 on the road, which is never easy. You know, you look to win 3 out of 4 at home and go .500 on the road, and that's going to get you close to 90 wins. And dude, they could have 90 wins by the end of August at this pace. Seattle's good. They're along that same lines. They're manufacturing runs. They've won 7 out of their last 10. But they can't play at home. They're 5-7 at home, which is very odd. But my biggest disappointment in the American League has got to be the Houston Astros. That rotation is just not – I mean, when Dallas Keuchel gives you 7 strong yesterday at home and only allows 2 runs – on Saturday, and you can't get him a win, what is going on?
I think they're more what we expected last year. Last year, I think, surprised us, and this year is just more of what they should have been last year. They're inconsistent, a little boom or bust, and you just can't count on them from day to day to day, whereas last year you kind of could because they were a little more hot than they were cold. It seemed like all year long, and it just seems like maybe this year maybe it caught up with them a little bit.
Yeah, this is a team that we expected to kind of, you know, progress into.
Right. They may have
just
overstepped
their progression. We thought that this was
going to
be how they were last year. Yeah, we thought that this was how they were going to be last year, and last year was how they were going to be this year. You know, so it's kind of flip-flop. So, you know, maybe they overperformed and they're regressing a little bit. I still like some of their pitching. Colin McHugh, he's a former Rockies guy.
Yeah, their bats are fine in the right spots, in the right contests and whatever else, absolutely. But you've got to understand that you're kind of poking the bear, you know, with rostering these guys, especially if you go full-on stacks. I mean, they define boom or bust.
Yeah, it unbelievably exactly. Let's see. I wanted to look at. There was one other thing I was looking at here. Where to go?
Okay. You got to close that porn down, dude.
No, it wasn't that. I went back to I was looking at the box scores. The Pittsburgh Pirates. Do you realize that over their last 10 games, they're only at 500, but they have the lowest road ERA out of anybody in that division, or anybody in the National League not named Chicago Cubs?
It doesn't surprise me in the least.
It is unbelievable. Unbelievable, the way that they are throwing and the way that they are pitching. And it has nothing to do with the way that they're pitching, because they're getting hit hard. The problem, or the and this is kind of going to segue, the deal is that they're in the right positions, and this goes to the shift. Of course, I'm a Rockies guy, and, you know, you see the shift and everything, and they've embraced the shift. You know, John Madden was instrumental in the – I think he kind of went into that next wave, and he had to, really, with being the Tampa Bay Rays manager. He had to get the most out of every ounce of talent that he had there in Tampa, and he did phenomenal taking them to the World Series and being in contention every single year. And now you give him talent like Chicago, and there's no surprise to me why they're the best team in baseball right now. You give a manager with that amount of talent, you give him that much talent on the field, and I mean, we could honestly be watching history. Now, I don't think that they're going to break the single season mark for most wins. I don't think they're going to break the 116 that the Mariners set back in 2002, you know, just because things happen. It's, you know, can somebody else be hot when they're going through what they would consider a dry spell? You know, can the Cards or the Pirates be hot at the right time to be able to close that gap?
Cardinals are already 9 games back.
Yeah, and they're not a bad team.
May 9th.
Yeah, they're not a bad team.
Yeah, we're not what we're accustomed to being, but we're not terrible. We're not bottom feeder. Yeah, we're not going good yet. I mean, really, where both things are synced up, pitching and bats. But I have no designs on thinking, and I said this back in February, this division is the Cubs to lose. The things that are going to get in their way would be a big head, maybe inexperience, or maybe injury, or maybe all three of those. But really and truly...
Well, we thought they were going to take a step back when they lost Kyle Schwarber.
Yeah, no.
They haven't. They've gotten better.
I've been afraid of the Cubs for 2 years or three. When I've got a buddy here that lives over in Illinois, and this guy and I go back and forth for years, and when they signed Theo Epstein, I was like, oh, crap. Cardinals just got served notice for about 5 years. Well, they did it in three or four, and you just knew. And then when they picked up Madden a couple of years ago, I was like, oh, crap. And then I was just like, God, once they shed these big contracts, they start developing within, they stockpile all those draft picks, and then they get a couple of competent guys at the top that know what to do and know how to assemble a team. And I was telling my buddy, I look forward to this. I want this to be a rivalry that means something. Now, I don't want to get my ass kicked repeatedly like is maybe happening this year. Cardinals are learning this year that they need to step up their game. And it wasn't for lack of trying in the offseason. They were in the running for David Price. They tried to re-sign Jason Hayward. It didn't work out, but then they stood pat. And they're paying the price a little bit for it now. And that's fine as long as this is a one-year thing or a six-month thing or whatever. That's fine. I do want to see this thing go for 5 years or 10 years, and I think that it might, because I don't think the Cardinals are really going anywhere as a franchise, but I do think the Cubs are here, and I think they damn kicked the Cardinals off the throne and said, yo, suckers, it's ours. And
then you add the Pirates.
The Pirates are always going to be the little guy caught in the middle, it appears, but to be quite – just because they can't afford what the Cubs can afford at this point. But to be quite honest with you, man, it's great. It's going to be one of the best divisions in baseball for years to come because you got three teams that now are fundamentally top to bottom in through their farm system and everywhere are in very good position to be good for years and years and years. And that's all a baseball fan ever really wants is to be good and be competitive and to keep taking your shots. And you got a third team in the mix now. Welcome to the Chicago Cubs. And it's great for St. Louis and for baseball in general, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Just like when the Red Sox and the Yankees are good, baseball is better
absolutely.
When the Cubs and the Cardinals have both significant teams that are really good.
Very rare.
And just to go down the Cubs lineup before we get into the theories of the shifting here and then we jump into the GPP strategy, Jason Hayward has not hit yet. He has not looked good. I don't know if...
He'll be fine.
He had the wrist injury or something like that happen. Dexter Fowler, this is the Dexter Fowler that the Rockies fans hoped he would develop into. Unfortunately, we just got rid of him for Jordan Lyles, and Jordan Lyles is now starting in AAA. Thank you, Dan O'Dowd. I appreciate that. Or if Dexter Fowler was still in Colorado, we wouldn't have Charlie Blackmon in center field. And I love Charlie Blackmon. I love Chuck Nasty. Chris Bryant, obviously, I would say top five third baseman in the National League. I'd put him in the National League. I'd probably put him number three.
You put him ahead of Votto at this point?
Third baseman? Votto's not a third baseman.
God, what was I thinking? I was looking at Rizzo next, and I think that...
Oh, yeah, I put Anthony Rizzo. He's probably, let's see, National League, he's probably one or two.
He would be the third baseman that would be ahead of Chris Bryant. Maybe Matt Carpenter, maybe.
I think Matt Carpenter is, because I think Chris Bryant's defense is lacking, and Nolan Arenado. Nolan Arenado is the best third baseman in baseball.
I agree, hitting and defense.
I mean, yeah, the only thing, in my opinion, he was the MVP last year, and the only reason that Bryce Harper got it was because of name, and I will continue to scream that. You look at the numbers and the peripherals, the only thing that Bryce Harper beat him in, other than stolen bases, was average, and he was on a better team.
Yeah, and it's funny how...
Because Nolan tied him for home runs, and people can say, oh, he's in Coors Field. The dude hit more home runs away from Coors than he did at Coors.
You know, we look up and down these lineups from a daily fantasy perspective, and we get so focused on the particular guy and what kind of matchup he's in today. I didn't really scan the National League roster for third baseman until you just mentioned that, and really and truly in the National League, it's pretty weak.
Yeah, there's three. And in my opinion, in the American League, there's really only there's really only one that can compete with those top three names, and that's Manny Machado.
Yeah.
You know, Travis Shaw, he's still young. He's got a long way to go. I think he could eventually be in that conversation. You know, I think Jung Ho Kong has the ability to be a top five third baseman.
But that's
in the National
if he stays
League.
There and doesn't keep bouncing back and forth from shortstop and say, you know, he seems defensively like more of a utility guy. His bat is for real.
Oh yeah, that's what I mean. If Clint Hurdle could just stick him at third base, which I think that's the plan because
the dude's cheap right now too.
You know,
he's so cheap right now.
Jody Mercer has performed very, very well so far, and you know, depending on if it's a righty or lefty, he's moved up or down. But with Todd Frazier going to the American League, that opened up a spot. You know, you've got
you'd have to consider a Josh Donaldson.
I think he's up there in the American League. I think Kyle Seager is up there.
You have to consider a Seager.
I think Matt Duffy has the ability to get up there. I don't think he'll ever hit for power.
That's really about it. So you got about three in each league.
You got about three or four in each league that are what you would consider to be elite. But it goes back to, and I'm like I said, I'm a Rockies honk, so I watch very, very hard this, and I want to get your idea of this. We've heard for years, since we started seeing the extreme shifts on players other than just like, you know, Big Poppy,
mm-hmm.
where it was an extreme left-handed shift and stuff like that. Now we're starting to see it all the time.
You're seeing it in weird counts. You're seeing it in weird situations.
I saw some things this weekend, okay? Do you realize that Carlos Gonzalez leads all of baseball in opposite field hits?
No, of course I didn't know that. I mean,
do you know what the Giants started doing this weekend?
Don't tell me reverse shifting on him.
They played him straight up. That is something that is, I believe, utterly, utterly important to understand.
Now, is he
and
normally
watch.
The guy that they shift on, and so they played him straight up because he goes oppo, or did they?
Because he is. He's not driving the ball with authority right now, but he's still hitting. Okay, his average really hasn't dropped. He had his first 0-for game yesterday. You know, I think he's 0-for his last six or something like that. But still, he's hitting the ball the other way. Okay, and Nolan started doing this. He started poking the ball through the right side of the infield. If these guys would start doing that to where they have to be honored and they stop having to dramatically shift all the time. Now, some teams are still going to do it, but, you know, when you start to see these things, that is going to reopen up everything
sure.
that they can do. And it is so, 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 it's like, duh.
What is the number one thing you're supposed to do at the plate? And I get it; it's a little bit
hit them where they
ain't. Different for different people, but don't make an out. Outs hurt your team. Reaching base helps your team. That's a very simplified way of saying it. It isn't perfect. I mean, you know, because you're going to want to hit the ball. But the fact is, even drawing a walk is better than grounding into, you know, a shift or something like that. So. For me, and then this is, I think, a lot like this shouldn't surprise you.
I don't know. Ask Bryce Harper if drawing a walk.
Well, I get you, but I mean, you shouldn't. but it's not making it out. And he doesn't have a choice right now, and that's a whole different story than where I'm going. If you know anything about me being the chalk eater, being the conservative guy, being the guy that doesn't like to make mistakes, I don't like making outs. I'm very much an Ichiro. In the fact that when I play softball with my guys, I got no power. And this may sound like the stupidest thing ever. I'm calling myself a baseball or softball player because I'm not. But when somebody wants to shift away from me and play me to pull, great. You can't do that to a guy like me because I can hit a ball the other way. I'm not talking about a 92-mile-an-hour outside slider. I'm talking about a freaking softball. But I can hit the ball the other way. You can't shift on me. your outfield can't play me to pull like we can other guys that we play softball against. It's a little similar principle in baseball in that go ahead, put all nine guys on the left side of the infield. I don't care. But that guy needs to learn, the batter needs to learn to poke one through the right side every once in a while because all he's going to do is shift those guys back over to playing him a little bit more straight up, which therefore opens the field for where he typically hits the ball. Isn't that the idea?
Yep.
I get it that you got a guy like a Mark Reynolds or a Brandon Moss or a Poppy or somebody like that, that if you hit it over all their heads, doesn't matter where the hell they stand.
Yeah, and Carlos and Nolan are two of those people that can do that. They have the ability. I mean, Nolan Arenado is leading the majors in home runs right now, and Carlos Gonzalez isn't far behind him. But you're talking about starting to be a change in the guard. For years, we were like, well, why don't these, you know, and you can make an argument. I don't want my three-hole bunting to get on base. You know, or my four-hole, because that's taking the bat out of his hands. And guess what? The defense
wins.
That
was the object of the Matt Adams debate here in St. Louis for a long time, because they started shifting on him, and then he started hitting into the shift. But Matt Adams can hit the other way. He's a 300 hitter in AAA, which doesn't translate necessarily to the majors, but it indicates that the guy can hit. His spray chart hit a little bit to all fields. So, again, he's not really the guy you should be shifting on as long as he's not trying to rip the cover off the ball. And he started last year. He didn't do very well, but he started trying to poke it through the shortstop hole and do some things that would lead to – and this is exactly what he's trying to do, is draw that infield and that outfield back over towards left field so that he can then hit into the holes that he naturally finds. Because if you put six guys over there, yeah, he's going to hit into it a lot unless he consciously goes away from it. And they're, oh, you don't want your three-hole, five-hole hitter. He wants to hit for power. You don't want to have him take all of his power away because then the defense wins. But you know what? He didn't make an out. And if he does it consistently enough, they'll have to honor it. It's a, why don't you guard me when I'm at the three-point line in basketball? Because I can't hit the shot. If I get one out
and
of
that's
five,
something...
you'd have to step out and put a hand in my face once in a while.
Yeah, it's just like when the Spurs are going to allow Andre Robertson to hit or to shoot three-pointers
yeah,
all
the
time.
Same stuff.
But it goes into this. You know, when you sit there and you look at it, you can go to Fangraphs and you can go to you can pull up teams against a shift, non-traditional. What's hilarious is the Rockies have a 469 wOBA with a 143 ISO against the
shift. Good. See, and
against right-handed or that's just it's not versus righties or lefties or whatever. The Cubs are number three at 403. You want to know who's number one on this list?
I couldn't even begin to tell you. I've never looked.
The Padres. Okay. Now they're not hit for any power, but Padres.
Yeah, I don't have to hit for power against a shift if I'm just dropping them in all the time, because you aren't going to get me out, and I'm just going to just keep turning the styles. Bing, 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 bing. Padres aren't doing that, obviously.
Yep.
But the philosophy is there, and it forces you to play more. If these guys, this is what kills me, and this is and not to beat the dead horse, but when people complain about the shift, oh, it's bad for baseball, it's bad. Is it? I don't think that it is. I think that if you put all nine guys on first base and have them all put one foot on the base and they all stand right there because that's where they think you're going to hit the ball, and I've got that whole rest of the field, and yes, I'm exaggerating, to hit into.
Yeah, it's your fault if you hit it there.
It's your dumbass fault for hitting into the ship. You should be focused and be trying to hit away from the ship because it does two things. Number one, it reaches base safely. Number two, it advances runners to A. And number three, so I guess it's three things, it forces them back to playing you straight up, and then you can beat them normally. I love the shift.
And that's something that you have to, you know, kind of take into consideration here. When you start looking at things and figuring things out and start going deep and start diving deeper as we get into the season at these analytics and stuff, as you start to watch more and more baseball games and you start to notice that teams are shifting more on guys that you're rostering, go look and see how they do against the shift. You know, if you've got a team, if you're facing the Cubs and you've got a team that you know, shifts a lot, and there's stats out there. You can see who shifts more than who, and, you know, whatever. And if your guy doesn't do well against the shift,
you need to reconsider playing him against that team.
You need to reconsider it, because there's a possibility that he could not do well.
He might be hitting 600 for the week.
But if he goes into Chicago,
he's not willing to change his game.
You know that Joe Maddon knows these numbers. Joe Madden's probably creator of Fangraphs, by the way. I'm just saying. But anyways, let's get into some. That's a little bit more advanced, and we will be happy to talk to anybody about it.
It's one of those things that is out there for you, and if you've got the time in your day and in your research process to go look it up, it can certainly give you a little bit of an advantage.
Right, we're not going to incorporate it into our numbers. It's something that I do look at, but it's not.
I'm not going to incorporate it in my write-up that this guy hits outside fastballs against the shift at a 350 clip over the past 7 days, and over the past 14 days it's this. I mean, that's going pretty damn deep, and I'm just not going to do that in a quick glancing article at a slate. But I'll tell you what, I'm not saying it's not worth looking at.
I look at it once a week,
at the time,
or whenever the series starts. You know, just kind of glance at it, look and see who shifts the most. Okay, we know the Chicago Cubs, they shift the most, or they shift a lot. Okay, so we've got the Padres going in there. Let me look at each individual, not that you would take a lot of Padres against the Cubs anyways, but it's an example. You know, let me look and see how, you know, Matt Kemp and Will Myers, how they all do against the shift. You know, okay, well, they don't do well. Well, fantastic, so I'm not going to worry about playing them. Oh, they do fantastic. Yeah. Guess what? Maybe I can sneak a couple low-owned guys in here and maybe steal some low-ownership guys in good spots that could be productive.
That guy right back there in the cubicle about three rows deep that's waiting for that fax to come in needs to wake up and listen to this, because what he just heard was a little bit of knowledge drop. When you're going and looking at shift numbers, strikeout numbers, who's scoring the most for the week, who's not scoring the most for the week. You do it when the series shifts. You do it on a Monday. You do it on after an off day, like on a Friday. Friday's probably the best day to do it because everybody plays Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Do it on those days. Look it up. Update your little numbers if you write them down, or if you've got a little Google Doc or a spreadsheet somewhere that you take some of these numbers and import them into, and then forget about it for 3 days. Look at who's doing typically – you know, who's doing the shifting and what teams do well against the shift, and then take that. You don't need to change that number for 3 days. If an offense is going really, really well and they're scoring the third most runs in the league over the past 10 days, you don't need to look at that number other than just at a glance for probably the next 3 games. And then when the series shift again, go look it up again. Go pull those numbers and make sure they're current. They don't need to be current every single day.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something to, you know, start to familiarize yourselves with how these teams play, because you can start to gain a little bit of an edge. And just because it doesn't work out, don't stop. The more I'm a firm believer in knowledge is power. Now, granted, there are times where you can just get just stupid and
probably something like analysis.
Information overload. Yeah. Information overload, exactly. That can happen. But if you know, the more knowledge you get, you'll start to learn how to apply it.
Well, what you'll do is you'll weed out the inefficient process. You'll start going overboard. The pendulum will swing to over-researching something, and you'll start going back to the basics, and then the pendulum will cut out the crap that didn't mean anything for you, and you'll only stick with the knowledge that was worth looking for. That was worth, and that'll become part of your routine. The other stuff will just kind of fall off the backside.
Yep, absolutely. So, all right, let's finish part three here of GPP strategy.
This will be pretty quick. I've only got a couple of questions left for you, to be honest with you. I wanted you to run down first. I don't know which one might go a little bit faster than the other. Let's do short slate, large slate first. When you're thinking of GPP and you see a 6-game slate versus a 15-game slate, are there specific adjustments that you make? Because it's a lot harder to get away from the herd in a 6-game slate than it is a 15-game slate.
Yes. Now, I want to preface this by saying, this is GPPs only. Okay, this has nothing to do with
cash. You're not worried about the herd.
If you were talking a six-game slate, I have to nail the chalk. And what I mean by that is this: is if you've got Jake Arrieta, and then you've got we just saw it last week. If you've got Jake Arrieta and then you've got there was somebody else I was throwing to. Oh, Matt Harvey against the Braves. And you've got Matt Harvey against the Braves, who's like, you know, $1,200 cheaper or whatever it was. And it was I think it was a smaller slate. Even if it wasn't, it doesn't matter. But if you've got those two throwing, okay, where you've got not as good or as dominant of a pitcher this year, but he's going against that far of inferior of a team, or you've got the Cy Young, the reigning Cy Young Award winner, and you know of Jake Arrieta going against a decent team, and I forgot who they were playing at the time. But, you know, you've got those two going. You have to nail the chalk on a short game slate. Because my first thing is I'm going to fade the high. I want to fade the highest owned position or player at each position.
Pitcher, so, you're fading him.
Pitcher, I'm
catcher,
fading
you if it happens to be.
It doesn't matter. I do not want the highest owned player at any position, unless he's a free square.
Meaning a dude that's just dirt-ass cheap and in a great, great, great spot with very little competition at that position elsewhere.
A $2,000 player that or Alex Presley.
Yeah.
Alex Presley this last weekend in Cincinnati. He's in a great hitter's ballpark. He's in a prime hitting position. He's cheap, and he's facing crap pitching.
Free square.
Because if a 2,000 player goes 0-4, guess what? It doesn't really hurt me as much as if a $4,000 player goes 0-4. So unless he's a free square,
no. But if he hits,
I have to nail the chalk on a.
But if he hits a three-run bomb and he's 70% owned because he was only a $2,000 player, that does hurt.
If I don't have him, yeah. You know. Alex Presley was 50% owned in cash games a couple nights ago, and he was the reason why I only won, like, I think 45% instead of swept all my cash games that night. Because he was 50% owned, I didn't have him in my lineup, and there you go. And he hit one. I had him in there the next day, and he was only 10% owned, and he hit one. Go figure, right? But yeah, I have to have
hashtag him DFS life.
No kidding, right? I have to have, but I had him in my lineup, and so I profited off the next one. But I have to nail the chalk for tournaments on the short game slate. On bigger slates,
you have to know what it is. Not mean you have to.
I have to know what it is.
You have to know what it is so you can get away from it.
Exactly. If I need to get away from it or not. Like, I'm not going to get away from a free square, because that's just stupid. But I am going to get away from, you know, Jake Arrieta being 65% owned and hoping that he doesn't have a – he doesn't throw a no-hitter with 15 strikeouts. You know, hoping that he doesn't go for 65 to 8.
It goes back to the boomer bust nature of a GPP. If you fade Jake Arrieta on purpose, hoping that he gets a no decision or hoping that he gets touched for a couple of runs or something like that, and your other guy competes.
Even if he gets 45 and my pitcher gets 35, if there's a huge difference in ownership percentage, I've now separated myself from the field because guess what? If I take Jake Arrieta at 13K on FanDuel and I've now got – you know, and I've got a $35,000 salary cap, and I've just used $13,000 of it on Jake Arrieta. Guess what? I am now picking from the exact same player field as 75% of the field. But if I fade him, even to go a little bit lower at $10,000, and I save that $3,000, guess what? I've opened up so many more options. Plus, I'm getting lower ownership players.
But the fact remains that if 60-70% of the people have him on that short slate, Arrieta, and he doesn't get it, because he's not going to win every, he's not going to go 32-0. And if it happens to be one of those games where he, you know, gives up a couple of runs or something like that, then all of a sudden you've got maneuverability. And if he does end up posting a 70-point performance,
you're dead
anyway.
You're dead anyway.
GPPs.
Unless your guy goes, unless your guy comes in comparable, and plus your bats do, if the highest owned player, and that's why you'll see me sometimes.
But you're not competing against.
It's early game.
You're not trying to compete against Arrieta when he throws a 70-point performance. That's not why you faded him on purpose. You're hoping
right,
that you're
70%. If my pitcher doesn't come in comparable, like for. The way to think of it is this. If 70% of the field is on Jake Arrieta, okay, and he goes for 70, if my pitcher doesn't get a 50 plus,
right,
you're dead.
But again, you don't care. Because you're specifically getting off of Arrieta because you want your pitcher to get you 40 to 50 points or whatever, and your bigger bats to go off when Arrieta falls flat and you find yourself alone at the top of the leaderboards. You don't care to be a top 20% lineup. That's just outside of the cash. It does you no. If you're a 21% lineup on that day and your bats went off and your pitcher just didn't perform and Arrieta had a great day, it doesn't mean shit to you. You might as well be dead ass last in these competitions, because that's not you're not cashing anyway. Your goal is to take that 80% gap from dead last to a 20% lineup and flush it when Arrieta only throws for 45.
Yep.
And then you jump all those guys bang that fast.
Yep. Now on large slates, I don't worry about the ownership percentage as much. If a guy's still going to be 70% owned, and if I feel he's going to be up there, and for pitchers it's above.
So what I'm hearing
for hitters, it's above.
What I'm hearing is on the bigger the slate, the less you worry about ownership percents in GPPs
for pitchers.
Okay.
For pitchers, I never want a guy unless he's a free square. Okay. I never want a guy over 20%.
Okay.
That's why you see me, at least not in GPPs, that's why you'll see me get creative with Coors Field stacks. I'll just do two here, two here, two here, or whatever. I will, where everybody's trying to save money to get cheap Coors Field exposure, I'll pay up. I'll go grab Nolan Arenado
and then punt in other places.
And then I'll punt in other places. You know, if
which would be something for tonight to think about.
Yeah, you know, you've got to read the slate as a whole. Know where the chalk is, and especially when Coors Field is on the slates, you have to think of. And you don't know for sure until the lineups come out, but you have to start to think of, you know, who's going to be, you know, highly owned. Paul Goldschmidt has been hitting the ball like dog crap. Guess what? He's Paul Goldschmidt in Coors Field tonight. Here's your chalk. Okay? So you've got to think about that. When it comes to large slates and small slates, large slates, I don't worry about the ownership for GPPs or the ownership for pitchers as much. I still would like my guy to be under 30%, but if he's 32, I'm not going to be upset, you know. But on a six-game slate, if he's 32% owned, I'm going to be absolutely I'm going to be upset with myself.
That makes sense to me. You know, I mean, because
so the ownership percentage on larger slates is more diversified.
Not by its very nature, you've got so many more choices. If we did this in NFL, we'd be saying the exact same things, and we do say it a little bit in NBA. But NFL is always pretty much a 16-game slate, week to week to week. So the ownership percentages don't really vary like we're thinking. Now, if you took the NFL stuff and you did a four-game express-type slate or just did a 1 p.m. only and did like seven games or something like that, yeah, you're going to notice a difference between Tom Brady's ownership on that slate versus the four-week slate. And that's what you're trying to get across.
The less amount of games that there are on the actual slate that you're playing, your threshold for ownership percentage has to increase. The less games, the more you have to, you know, you have to up it, you know, where you normally don't want, I normally don't want a hitter, any more than 15%. Well, on a six game slate, I jump it to 20.
Yeah. 15% is a good thing on a six game slate.
Yeah.
The only reason why is because in six games, you know, you got 12 teams versus 30 whatever teams, and when you've only got the 12 teams, there's a very, very finite pool of relevant players.
Yeah, and everybody's
going to pick
whether
them.
You think it or not. We all kind of get the same information. Like, we're all pulling from the same statistics. Nobody has some secret statistic that they are, you know, using that maybe they created it to work to in their own formula and model, but they're all pulling the baseline right. statistics that we all have access to.
I guess the ownership percentage having to change from size of slate, is there any other strategy or tip that you use between big and small slates?
Yeah, I'll usually, if everybody's like saving on shortstop or they're saving on second base, I think I've said this before, I'll try to pay up there. I'll pay up to be different. So like if everybody's saying, you know, you got to pay up at first base, well, I'll go try to save because first base I can find cheap power. Used to be Matt Adams, you know, used to be, you know, you can find cheap power at certain spots that you don't have to worry about rostering a $4,000 guy.
It's one of those things that goes the other way. When I'm telling you, when you asked a couple of podcasts ago, what do you typically do at catcher? And I said, to be quite honest with you, I typically punt at catcher. That instantly tells you
that I'm going to spend around $3,000 at least.
Right, tend to pay up a little bit at catcher because you'll be off of the guys, the natural mindset of people.
And it's always slate dependent and matchup dependent. So, I mean, this isn't, they're not.
Yeah, you're not going to go throw Buster Posey out there against Jake Arrieta without numbers telling you that it's going to be a successful situation. That's paying up to be stupid.
Right.
But you're going to consider it if everybody's punting the position. You're going to go look at those numbers and see if they make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
What about multi-entry and single-entry? How do you treat those differently?
Single-entry, I will...
If I had just a 10-game slate and I was playing a single-entry or a multi-entry tournament, which one would you pick and why and how would you attack it?
I love single-entry tournaments. Now, that's not saying I don't play multi-entry tournaments because I do that as well, but I love single-entry tournaments. And I think it's the first thing I do is I try to I'll put, say you go to the 25, the 10, the 5, the 2, and the 1. So that's 35, 40, that's $43, okay? And say you're just playing single entry tournaments. That's six tournaments. I'll make two lineups, and I'll try to even out the money as much as possible. As far as investment. So I'll go like the $25 will have the same lineup as the $1. Then the $2 tournament will have the same lineup as the $10 tournament. And then...
So if you got $43, you're going to pretty much try and put $20 in each one. Or split it out
right,
20
exactly.
and 20.
Yeah, I'm going to try to split it.
And so you're going to have to go high, low, and then work your way into the... And then the other lineup's going to pretty much have to chew up all the middle price stuff.
Right, exactly. And what I'll do is I'll kind of evaluate it because you'll see a lot of players, they put cash lineups in single entries.
Well, my question would be why two entries?
Because
It depends. If that's all I'm playing for the night, along with my cash games, then one of the teams will be my cash game lineup, and then I'll make another GPP team to where it's a little bit different. If I'm just playing the single entry tournaments that night, I'll just make one lineup. Like if it's a short game slate, if it's like a 6-game slate, and I go through, I'll make one team, and I'll put it in every single entry.
So all $43 will just be the same lineup on a shorter slate like that.
Right, and I'll just ride or die with one team. And usually, I mean, I've some of my biggest nights in baseball is where my single entry GPP team has swept the board through that. I mean, I'm talking from the $100 level down, has swept the board, and I don't know how it happened, but it also finished second in a qualifier. I mean,
that makes sense, because that one lineup, if I did, there's two ways to do this, and I hope this is kind of what you're getting. I don't mean to steal your thunder, but obviously with one lineup, there's no player diversification whatsoever. I'm all in on everybody. If I have 10 lineups, then I'm treating these players a little bit more like a mutual fund stock share, in that I'll have 30% of this guy, 50% of this guy, 20% of this guy, and 10% of all of these guys, and I'll treat it as a unit. So where I'm doing single entry tournaments, if I'm just doing one lineup from top to bottom, it's going to be a very, very boom or bust nature, whereas I've got some player diversification in the
multiple. Well, not really, because you don't want it to be boom or bust, because at least you want it to be able to compete.
I don't mean
cash.
It's constructed with boomer bust players. I mean it's a boomer bust result that night.
Yes.
I mean there's no other way around. It's either going to cash everywhere or it's going to cash nowhere. You know, it may not win every tournament you enter, but if it's cashing hard, it's cashing in every tournament that you entered it into. You know, at least a little bit. But if it fails to cash in any tournament, it failed to cash in all of them. You know, so That boom or bust result nature is very indicative of one lineup, where what I'm doing by spreading my exposure to multiple players is I'm really hedging myself. I'm covering my ass.
Yeah, and that's where, like, on larger slates like tonight, you know, 13 games tonight, I will be playing multi-entry tournaments. Now, that doesn't mean I'm throwing in 50 teams, you know, but
how many do you typically make? How many lineups do you typically make on a slate like tonight? 13 games?
36.
Okay. So it's not a ton.
No, it's not a ton. But what I'll do is I'll make 3 to 6 teams, and I'll go put all those in the slam. And then I'll go put all of them in the $10 tournament, and then all of them in the $5. And so I treat each one like I would a single entry, but I'm putting them in each tournament buy-in that I'm comfortable with. You know, the 1, the 2, the 5, the 10, the 25, or whatever I feel like I need to play that night. You know, and one of those teams is always, always, always your cash game.
Of course.
You know.
I say that like everybody should know that. I don't mean it that way. But for people that are maybe just listening or just learning, you take your one lineup for cash games and you absolutely throw it into a tournament, because the chalk does go off. You do end up with the perfect combination for your research that day, to where you've created the best possible lineup you could have created, and it does win tournaments. It wins 100-man leagues. It wins a lot. And on those nights, if you're just putting it in 5 head-to-head competitions, we've got countless examples of Army members that have learned this lesson the hard way, myself included, Kevin included. That's why we've started trying to preach this as much as we have. If you're creating one lineup and you're putting it in 1,000 different cash games, you absolutely have to throw it in at least one tournament, because if it does go off and you're sweeping all of your cash games, it would have hit really hard in a tournament too.
I would say it's even a little bit different than that. I would say that you need to put in if you are making multiple teams, okay, every single every single tournament that you enter needs to have your cash game team. If you're going to enter multiple tournaments, and I'll just give you an idea about this on FanDuel, okay? Say you go to the lobby, and you sit there, and you go, oh, okay, well, the squeeze is back down to $2. I want to enter that one. I want to do the slam tonight. It's a $100,000 guarantee. I want to do that one. I'm not going to make different teams for each one of these freaking tournaments. I'm going to make the exact same team. I'm going to make one team, and I'm going to enter it in every single tournament. Okay? If I'm throwing single bullets at these larger field tournaments, I'm making one team and I'm going. Okay? But if I'm making multiple teams, I would rather take, you know, $50. I would rather take four shots at the $5 and four shots at the $3 and four shots at the
$1. So if you've got $50 and you've got five lineups, that's $10 per lineup that you're using, and you're going to pick, say, $10 worth of tournaments and enter
all
five
like
lineups
five,
the same?
I would go, yep, I would go 5-2-1, and that would be, $8, 40.
Six lineups. For $50. For $48.
Right.
So, but what I'm getting at is you would pick a tournament that, or a set of tournaments that allow those six entries in there, and you're going to do six entries into the same $5 tournament, into the same $2 tournament, the same $1 tournament, and that way you've got effectively all six lineups equally exposed, so that when one does hit, it didn't just win a little $1 thing for $2,000. It also won a $5 tournament for $10,000. Or something like that. You're trying to
maximize the upside on the number of lineups.
And that's one thing that we see a lot of beginners do, where they say, well, I built three lineups, and I put $1 into here, and a $2 one into there, and a $5 one into there. And
I used to do it.
It's
I used to build. I used to play cash games. When I first started, I used to play cash games, okay? And because I was just learning it and everything. And there was an NFL week couple years ago, I think I had $100 in play in cash games and 50-50s and stuff, because that was, everybody was talking about, oh, you play 80% 50-50s in cash games and then 20% GPPs and everything. I had a different lineup for every damn contest I was in.
Because that's what you thought you were supposed to do.
Yeah, and then I'm sitting here going, well, my theory was, I didn't know what I was doing, and I was going to win some of them. But my theory was, is I didn't want to go all in on somebody because of this, because what if they suck? Then I'm going to lose all this money. Well, guess what? I was also
costing yourself if they all did well.
Yeah.
Now, if I can catch my train of thought there, it just left the station. When you're doing that, when you're rostering, well, shit. I forgot. If you're doing 3-6 lineups and you're doing 3-6 different lineups, how does your player distribution typically fall? The popular term for football is all in, even though we tell people constantly we're never 100% on any one player. What is the highest percentage you'll go on? I mean, let's, for easy math, do 10 lineups. What's the highest exposure you'll have to any single player?
60%, and I've got to be in love with them enough to where I want to marry them.
So, and what position is that typically? Does it vary, or is it typically a pitcher, or is it typically, does it bounce?
It varies.
Because I know for myself,
if it's a free square, a $2,000 Aaron Hicks going up, in batting in the two hole, then, there you go.
I know what I was going to say before. It was very similar to this, because if you're one of those guys and you build one lineup, yes, you're all in on everybody in that particular lineup for that day. And if you add a second lineup, and then add a third lineup, and then add a fourth lineup, and add a fifth lineup, the further and further and further and further down you go, you're mixing your players a little bit. In theory, you're not going with your best picks at every single position. You're starting to dilute your lineup a little bit. Now, whereas in multi-entry GPPs, that can absolutely help you get on the right mix of players. So the reason I ask about the all-in thing is, we don't want to go completely all in on somebody when we've got others to fall back on, but at the same time, we don't want to be so diversified either that we,
to where we don't hit, right. You don't have
so we got no exposure, no weighted exposure to anything. So where's that mix between single entry and multi-entry? Where is it? You're saying 60% at most. Are you typically around 30 to 40% on people? How about this? Do you form a core of guys that you really, really like and then expose them to about half of your lineups?
Yeah, I have usually a core about, if I'm making multi-entries, I have a core of about three or four that I'll have at least. If my core is four, like there's four that I absolutely love, I'll have at least three of them in every lineup.
And, okay, are they typically value plays or are they typically?
Depending on the matchups and everything like that, it could be, you know, whoever. Like tonight, Nolan Arenado. He'll be in 60% of my lineups. You know, Carlos Gonzalez will be probably in 40% of my lineups. You know, just arbitrary numbers. But, and you sit there and you look at things and you understand as you start to get into it. I never want to teach somebody how to start to build multi lineups because past six lineups, past 10 lineups, like if you want me to build 50 lineups, I'm not that good yet at building 50 lineups that can compete. You know, I'm not a mass multi-entry type player. I'm going to give you my best 4 to 7 mm-hmm. shots, 10 max, unless I, you know, satellite into tournaments. I'm going to give you my best shots and I'm going to go to war with you. Because I feel that I am good enough to where mano a mano, you know, you get five lineups, I get five lineups. I'll even go down to one. You get one, I get one. I'm going to beat you more times than you're going to beat me. And there are very, very few players that I feel like can hold a candle to that. And that's not being arrogant or anything like that. I'm just that confident in it. That's why I do a lot of these single entry tournaments. Now, when I'm going after a qualifier, I'll go 10 if I have to, you know, I pick and choose my spots now. I don't just go for qualifiers just blindly anymore. But, you know, if I choose 10, then I'm going to give you my best shots and it's going to be surrounded by a core with other players that I like.
Mixing. Okay. If there's, well, that's too general. I know for me, two things. Number one, when we talk about the ladder, and I go back mostly to NFL, I do it a little bit in baseball, I do it a little bit in basketball, whatever. When I'm really running and gunning and am putting in a large portion of my bankroll because I really, really like a slate, I'm going to build more than one lineup because I don't want to be, you know, live or die with one set of players when I'm running the way the ladder is constructed, I can enter three lineups, and if one does well, it pays for everything anyway. And if one does well and one does mediocre, I'm in house money again. And I've spread myself out, like we're talking about with player diversification, enough that I'm casting a wider net at the prize pool. I have a little bit better chance at catching on to something. But I do that typically with a little bit of a core as well. For me, personally, I typically do it with my pitcher because I feel that I can identify pitchers. And yes, I'm a chalky guy, but I feel that I can usually pick out a pitcher fairly well that is going to be competitive. And so I'll just run my same pitcher in all three lineups. I may do two in one and then a value guy in another or something like that just as a little bit of a hedge so that I can get up into some other bats in terms of baseball. But I'm typically going, if I'm going to go all in on a player, it's going to be on the pitcher because I feel that's my best shot at hitting on the right guy. And
yeah, I mean, you could do that with pitching.
And that was what
like
I wanted
that,
to so. Ask because that's why I was asking what position you typically go all in on, if any, because for me it makes more sense. And that doesn't mean that in NFL we do that with the quarterback, but I'm just saying that in baseball the pitcher seems to be that important most times. That's kind of where we're
but
start.
See
in tournaments you can't.
It depends. If it's the chalk pitcher, I'm not.
You're not on
him
at all, typically.
Right. I might have one or two lineups, you know, and build around it just in case. But if I'm building, you know, 10, I might have one or two. But you know, normally if it's the chalk pitcher, I'm not going to do that at all because what I'm going to do is if I like that pitcher, there's other people that are going to like it.
And
that makes total sense to me, in that you would take three value pitchers if you were building three lineups and do one in this one and one in this one and one in this one, because you don't know which one's going to go off and have the great performance, so you can't go all in on one of them. Whereas with the chalky pitcher, I kind of can, but I'm not doing that in GPPs and single-entry GPPs like you are. That's where we're a little different. I'm doing that in more of a ladder strategy, which bases itself in cash and builds from the ground up, so I'm not as worried about the ownership percentages of that pitcher. So that is actually good that you pointed that out to clarify to people that we're doing this with different styles and constructing our lineups a little bit differently.
Yep, absolutely.
Awesome. So that's good for me. I mean, as far as discussing those last two points, unless you have something that you want to dive a little deeper into.
Nope, actually not right now. Okay. I was about to say that's going to do it for the GPP series that we did. Obviously, we could keep talking about this stuff.
I reserve the right to bring up a question that I think of GPP related at a different spot in a different podcast, because I will continue to think of these GPP type questions as I'm rostering cash games, because as I'm trying to do cash, these little thoughts always pop. Well, what if? Well, what if? Well, what if? For me, those contrarian thoughts are GPP thoughts, and I usually try to write them down, and then I'll try and ask you at a later time.
Yep, absolutely. And, guys, if you have any questions for me or Chop that you want to hear on the podcast, just go ahead and let us know. You can DM us, and we'll try to get them in and
you
everything.
You know what? Throw your Twitter handle out there, too, for people.
Yeah, that's what I was about to do. Make sure you that's going to do it for us today, actually. Make sure you turn into Triple Play on – we post a link in the Slack and on Twitter. My Twitter is at BoomersDFSDaddy. I also control the DFS Army Twitter handle. That's at DFS Army. Chop, you're at Chopography.
Yeah, Chopography. That's pretty fast. That really rolled off the tongue. But yes, that's my Twitter handle. So anybody can follow either one of us that way too if you're not a member of the DFS Army. But of course, we would strongly encourage you to become a member, because with 140 characters, as you can tell, I am not a short-winded guy. I prefer to talk in Slack where I can expand on my thoughts a little bit.
Yep, and then you can hear me argue with his expanded thoughts.
Almost every time.
Yeah, not all the time, but almost every time, especially when he starts to say that John Gray's not a good pitcher. So, anyway, that's going to do it for us today, because we have research to do and things to accomplish and lineups to build. Make sure you turn into Triple Play at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Central, with myself and the return of my bearded friend, Mr. Al Walsh DFS. For DFSArmy.com and the DFS Army, there is your orders. You have them now. Go out and execute, and let's make some money.
Hoo-ah!